Chapter 15. Strolling into Papua. It was the end of 1966, and the end of my first year at the National Art School in Sydney. When I arrived back in Kundiawa for the Christmas holidays, I discovered a grand adventure had been planned that would make my stay both memorable and fun. This time the adventure was a most unusual one. To be part of a 5-day government foot patrol to the Papuan border and back. I was just 18 and up for an adventure. But before we left Kundiawa to begin the patrol, there were things to do and people to visit. My mother was based in this small Eastern Highlands township that was home to a collection of fascinating characters doing interesting things, in spite of the isolation, or, possibly, because of it. Occasionally, we'd receive an invitation to visit their homes after work, for a sundowner, as drinking was the preferred, out-of-hours pastime, throughout New Guinea. One character in particular is a standout from this time. Fred Parker was a patrol officer, known as Akiap in Tok Pisin, who was living in a small dongar not far from district office, the administrative heart of Simbu province. Fred had a disconcerting hobby, collecting snakes. All kinds of snakes, both venomous and non-venomous. Batches of his venomous snakes were periodically flown to Australia, to be milked by experts. The milk then used to produce antivenom. Fred encouraged the locals to collect snakes on his behalf, so, there was always a steady stream of snake offerings to his back door. Inside his donga, the walls were lined with numerous wooden tea chests, leaving little room for furniture, so finding a place to sit to enjoy a sundowner could be a challenge. Fred's party trick was to ply his guests with grog before upending a tea chest full of pythons, and then standing back to watch, with ill-concealed glee, as his guests scattered. In the scramble that followed, he noted which of his visitors were first to reach the higher places, the sink, the dining table, or for the super athletic, the top of the refrigerator. He would then return the snakes to their tea chest, whilst heart rates returned to normal, and pre-dinner drinks conversation gradually resumed. I only remember one sundowner gathering at Fred's house. It was a frightening experience, and one I wasn't particularly keen to repeat. As the wool project was my mother's purpose for living in Kundiawa, it's fitting to provide a little background before proceeding further with my recollections. The idea of introducing a hand textile industry into the highlands of New Guinea was the brainchild of Kiap Ian Burnett, who came to New Guinea in 1955. Whilst posted in the highlands, he hatched a plan to benefit the local people. He would teach them to weave. He hoped that after learning how, they would be able to use imported Australian wool to produce saleable woven items. He succeeded in getting his pilot project off the ground in Gumani village, south of Kundiawa, which was no mean feat for a novice. After which, he left the Department of Native Affairs and moved across to the Department of Trade and Industry, determined to expand his pilot project. To do this, he needed someone with professional textile design and production skills. He approached Professor Johnston, at the University of Technology, in Sydney, to ask if he could recommend someone for such a venture. Professor Johnston, my mother's former boss, immediately replied, "Yes. The best person is Gretchen Granger, who's already in New Guinea." Ian Burnett then asked my mother to head up the project. To do this, she moved from the Department of Education, where she had been teaching art for some years, to the Department of Trade and Industry. With the deal sealed, the wool project was born. The Highland settlement of Kundiawa was selected to be the base of operations for the wool project, as it had an established junior technical school with staff, students and workshops, able to build weaving looms, and all the other equipment needed. Ian Burnett's strategy for attracting support for the weaving business was a clever one. At the start, the word was spread through the tight network of Kiaps, who were mostly single men, posted to remote Highland outstations. They were being offered the opportunity to introduce this new business to their people, if they considered it a good fit. If so, the Kiap would approach my mother, to discuss what was involved. With the Kiap on side, my mother was assured of his full support for the project. This was particularly important from the get-go, when there would be inevitable teething problems, whilst the recruited tribesmen were in training and the supply lines were being established. My mother would periodically visit outstations to troubleshoot. Also, to offer encouragement, to deliver additional training and provide new product designs, as well as the yarns to produce them. Some outstations produced hand-spun yarn and wove it into fabulous floor mats. Others wove raw fleece floor mats and ponchos, and still others wove blankets. The weavers were paid per item woven. Now, to return to the planned adventure. Definitely my mother's best effort yet. A 5-day patrol into Papua. Mike Baker was the Kiap at Karamui Outstation, situated south of Kundiawa, some 3 days' walk from the Papuan border. There was no road into Karamui, so the only way to get there was by small aircraft. Mike had overseen the introduction of the wool project for his people, the Haiya and Pawia. He saw this venture as their entree into the cash economy, to supplement their subsistence lifestyle. During the wool project set up at Karamui, Mike and my mother had become friends. Mike's job often took him away from the outstation, to check on villages in more remote and inaccessible parts of Simbu province. When Mike mentioned the possibility of the Granger women joining him on patrol to the Papuan border, my mother accepted in a heartbeat, as she was always up for an adventure. On this patrol, we would be in the company of Mike, his cook boy, 6 police boys armed with 303 rifles, 15 patrol boxes and some 30 carriers. On the appointed day we flew into Karamui in a Cessna 337, loaded with wool project supplies, of fleece and yarn for the weavers, in addition to our patrol kit of shirts, trousers and sturdy walking shoes. Early next morning, we headed out. I was fresh from the city, and accustomed to walking on paved streets with shallow inclines, but this was very different. There was no road, only a rough walking track, worn smooth by bare feet, with a split timber bridge to span the occasional creek. Mike, my mother and I, led the patrol, and set a steady pace. But the worst was yet to come. The descent down the side of a 1,000-foot ravine, with a fast-flowing river at the bottom. We made it to the bottom without mishap, and thankfully, the men who guided me over the rickety pole bridge across the river, kindly offered to haul me up the other side of this very steep ravine. I was somewhat embarrassed to need help, in light of the all-pervasive colonial attitude of white man's superiority that was alive and well at the time. But as a woman, I was probably off the hook. Thankfully, on this patrol, there was only one major ravine to negotiate. On the flat, we ambled along. The patrol had been alerted to my mother's recently developed passion for bush orchids. So, whenever an orchid was spotted high up in a tree, it was the signal for the patrol to stop, whilst one of the party, with verbal encouragement aplenty from the rest of us, clambered up to dislodge it and add it to the growing collection. After which, the patrol continued. We spent each night in the various house kiaps dotted along the way. These buildings were for the exclusive use of the kiap when on patrol. They were built by the villagers in the traditional style, using bush materials, and raised off the ground on stilts, with log steps and an arched roof. Mike's patrols were very well organized. The cook boy would go on ahead to prepare hot water for a bucket shower, and cook a delicious meal, both most welcome at the end of a long day's walk. What luxury, in the vastness of the bush surrounding us. For the first couple of days of the patrol, I remember being very stiff, but was reluctant to admit it, as I wanted to avoid being considered a softie from the city. On day 3, we reached our destination, a small village very close to the border with Papua. My mother and I were the first white women to visit this village, and the reception we received from the villagers is one I'll never forget. When we got to the center of the village, I was told to stand very still, whilst a cluster of old women hooped and hollered, as they took turns to feel my leg muscles, through my jeans. I stood rooted to the spot, for what seemed an age, until each woman had carefully squeezed each of my legs, from ankle to crotch, in what proved to be an extremely unnerving experience. Afterwards, a number of jokey explanations were proffered. For example, that I was being sized up for eating, and, or, assessed for my gardening ability, in this hilly terrain. Neither explanation appealed to me in the slightest. I don't remember much of the return trip. In truth, I was hanging out for it to be over, as I was tired, dirty and craving creature comforts, so I was delighted when Karamui outstation hove into view. On our return it was unusually chilly, and for some reason I hadn't brought a sweater with me. Mike, our ever-considerate host, offered me his cream hand-knitted Aran sweater, which was a farewell gift from his mother when he left his home in Ireland, to explore the wilds of New Guinea. When I was clean and warmly dressed, Mike and I headed out to the primitive grass volleyball court behind the house to have a game of singles. Attempting an impossible return, I tripped and fell face down onto a slimy log, lying alongside the court, smearing rotten bark down the front of Mike's precious sweater. What to do? The logical thing. I offered to wash it, as I was concerned the ground and mucky stuff would permanently stain the sweater. After a careful washing, to my great relief, all the marks came away. Thankfully, it was a perfect drying day. With no way to remove the excess water, rather than using the washing line, I made the fateful decision to lay the sweater out flat to dry, on the lush green grass in the backyard. The reason? I was concerned that if the waterlogged sweater was suspended from the washing line, it would stretch out of shape. Unbeknownst to me, that day was lawn mowing day at Karamui, where the grass grew super fast because it rained heavily and often. A fancy ride-on mower with an extra wide cutting path was the station's pride and joy, and the mower boy was always keen to fire it up. But on this day, his enthusiasm was misplaced. When he came to mow the backyard. Instead of going around the sweater, he mowed right over the top of it as if it was invisible. When I saw the lawn, scattered with clumps of crimped lengths of cream wool, I couldn't believe my eyes. A split second later, I let out a long, loud, involuntary scream of anguish that could be heard all over the station. Once I'd recovered from the shock, self-condemnation began. After a time, this emotion gave way to incredulity. How could this happen? It took a while and a couple of stiff whiskies to settle me down, after which we began to plan sourcing a replacement sweater from Ireland. This would be a challenge from the remote New Guinea highlands, but not impossible. The next day, the Cessna 337 returned to Karamui to take us back to Kundiawa. As we took off, I was so relieved to see the scene of the sweater mangling catastrophe disappear behind us. Ever after, the sweater incident was hardly mentioned, but the five-day patrol out of Karamui was, and still is. In the retelling, it's described as a gentle stroll into Papua. Of course, this is a massive understatement. On reflection. On patrol. I look back on our patrol experience and realize how fortunate we were to be included in this adventure. It gave us the opportunity to see parts of New Guinea most expatriates would never see, though, at the time, I simply took it in my stride. Social anthropology. My interest in social anthropology was first kindled whilst we lived amongst the Tolai people, in Rabaul. I learned some words in Kuanua, the Tolai language. Words I remember to this day. Our opportunity to visit a very remote village, at the southern boundary of the Simbu province, was made possible by Mike Baker. The experience provided a natural extension of my interest in the New Guinea people and their way of life. My mother noted my interest, and when I'd completed my art studies, she suggested I consider enrolling in a social anthropology degree at the University of Papua New Guinea. But after 3 years full-time study at the National Art School, I desperately wanted to get a job and earn my own money, using the commercial arts skills I'd acquired. Facts. A patrol officer's life. Highly regarded former KIAP, Jim Sinclair, wrote of his KIAPing experiences as follows. The years so spent are in many ways the finest and most rewarding of the patrol officer's life, filled with the satisfaction of country covered, new people seen and new mountains climbed. This is true for each of the KIAPs mentioned in this story, Ian Burnett, Fred Parker and Mike Baker. Their extraordinary experiences during various postings throughout New Guinea formed the foundation of their future careers. Patrol Officer Ian Burnett. Ian was the son of 1960 Nobel Prize winner, Sir Frank Macfarlane Burnett, the eminent Australian virologist. In 1955, Ian began his time in Papua New Guinea as a cadet patrol officer at Lorengo, then Manus Island, and later postings in the highlands to Gumani, Bumai, and Lufa. Ian was instrumental in gaining funding from the World Bank and the United Nations Development Project for constructing the Highlands Highway. He was a talk-pissing interpreter for the first Papua New Guinea House of Assembly, vice president of the Public Service Association, and represented permanent officers during actuarial negotiations in the early 1970s. He was a member of the Papua New Guinea Tariff Board and Passenger Motor Vehicle Board before leaving Papua New Guinea in 1974. Patrol Officer Fred Parker. This man's passion was wildlife. He spent time collecting reptiles whilst he was living in the highlands, and has a number of species named for him. The blind snake, Garopolis fredparkeri. The Karamui Basin white-lipped python, Bothrochilus fredparkeri, also known as Liopithon fredparkeri. And the snake-necked turtle, Caladina fredparkeri. Patrol Officer Mike Baker. Mike Baker left Simbu Province in 1968 to work with Consinc Rio Tinto Australia on Bougainville. His job was a difficult one, as it involved negotiating with the Dharanai people, whose land was being destroyed by Consinc Rio Tinto's Panguna copper mine. Whilst jogging early one morning, he was shot 6 times, after which he was medevaced to Australia. He was lucky to survive. When he recovered, I understand he continued to work with Consinc Rio Tinto until his retirement. He didn't return to Papua New Guinea. Patrol officers. More than 2,000 Australians served as patrol officers and district officers in the former territory of Papua and New Guinea between 1949 and 1974. They were commonly known as KIAPs, a talk-pissing version of the German word for captain. Young men, aged between 18 and 24, with initiative, imagination, and courage were encouraged to apply to become cadet patrol officers in Papua and New Guinea. Successful applicants attended the Australian School of Pacific Administration before being dispatched to Papua or New Guinea for field experience, under the supervision of a veteran KIAP. After a 21-month term, a cadet became a patrol officer. They were required to maintain law and order, as commissioned officers, in the field division of the Royal Papua and New Guinea Constabulary, and to serve as magistrates of local courts. They introduced and maintained postal services, radio communication, roads and airstrips. They regularly patrolled villages and maintained contact with village leaders. Their role was to bring the benefits of modern civilization and a form of governance to all villages in their jurisdiction. They were also required to write detailed reports about their patrols, providing observations of village life, health needs, languages spoken, land disputes, initiation ceremonies, food production, building and cooking methods. These reports have been archived and provide a wealth of information for those researching Papua New Guinea's post-World War II colonial history.